if you know what I mean.
Oh, I'm getting too old for this shit.
You and me both, sir.
She sighed, feeling the weight of yet another world on her shoulders.
Em, Dave said quietly when he saw her standing by herself, eyes downcast, slowly shaking her head. What's going on?
Dave.
She needed a hug. He looked like he needed a hug, too. Instead, she flipped up her helmet faceplate and rested a hand on his shoulder.
Hey.
He lifted his faceplate, looking into her eyes with concern.
Em, what's wrong?
She took a breath.
We are in big fucking trouble.
Yeah, so that's nothing new. His attempt at humor fell flat.
Hey, come on. We'll be just fine once the second wave gets their lazy asses down here and...
There won't be a second wave, she hissed, looking around to assure they were not being overheard. Admiral Kuhn won't risk his assault carriers unless he can be sure there aren't more Bosphorak warships in the area. Dave, I hate to say it, but I agree with him. We could lose the entire second wave before their boots hit the ground.
Shit.
He looked away, clenching a fist.
All right, screw it.
If the birds can send in ships, then we call the Beatles.
We can't. They can't interfere, you know that.
Then why are the Bosphorak able to break the rules?
The rules are the same.
She shook her head.
The circumstances are different. The Bosphorak can act here directly because legally, this fight is in an internal dispute within the Maxalt's coalition. The Kristang are invading a Wergalan planet. The rest of us just happen to be here. The Bosphorak are within their rights to intervene. If the Beatles intervene to help us, they will be breaking the rules.
This sucks. Hey. He leaned forward so their noses were almost touching, and he stroked her cheek with a hand. You have a sneaky plan to pull us off this rock, right? Please tell me you have a plan. She kissed his fingers, then pulled away.
I have a plan, but...
She stomped a foot in the well-trampled dirt.
We are not retreating off this rock.
Shit.
Thank you.
For what?
For reminding me why we're out here.
I didn't want to do this. I was trying to think of a way to avoid doing this. Now I see we don't have a choice. He looked askance at the Maverick's leader.
Do what?
Use our ace in the hole.
Oh.
He knew what she meant, and how much she wanted to hold that card for a higher purpose. They couldn't play any cards at all if they were dead.
Is there anything I can do?
Yes.
Tell me I'm doing the right thing.
Always. The sure thing received the garbled signal from Perkins, and there was a delay while the crew furiously wagered on what this latest development could mean. Then, they complied with the order by launching 8 probes and settled down once again to wait and wonder just what the hell was going on down there. The 8 probes accelerated toward the planet at high speed, then cut thrust and engaged stealth fields as they coasted toward the war-torn world. At the last moment, before they struck the atmosphere too hard, the probes flipped around and burned the last of their fuel to decelerate, slowing to match the speed of the thousands of pieces of debris that were constantly falling out of orbit. Nose cones popped open, ejecting their payloads, which soon became just more flaming pieces of junk following ballistic arcs toward the surface. 7 of the payload modules began transmitting back data they collected about conditions in the atmosphere, which the computers of the Sure Thing dutifully collected, though the crew of the ship had no idea why anyone would care about such mundane information during a raging battle. The 8th probe's payload apparently had failed, because while it was transmitting a signal like the others, the data sent back was useless garbage. All 8 probes fell deeper and deeper into the atmosphere, slowing and falling at a steeper angle until parachutes popped out to bring their descent speed to a gentle rate. The 8 stealth payloads floated downward under their gossamer-thin, invisible parachutes, slowly drifting apart. 7 of the parachutes guided their payloads to touch down in bodies of water where they disappeared with barely a splash and sank to the bottom, their payloads going inert as the power was cut. The 8th payload, for which the other 7 were merely decoys,
guided itself toward a soft landing in an overgrown field outside a small, abandoned military base. No longer needed, the parachute detached and soared away on the wind, disintegrating into microscopic particles that would soon be consumed by the plant life of the world. By itself, the payload container swung open, and the contents unpacked themselves, with a small bot unfolding to carry the main item in the container. The bot scanned the area, finding it to be very close to what it expected, so it began walking toward an abandoned warehouse building, carrying the main item. Inside, it activated its scanner again, building a map of the structure. Quickly, it saw a pile of discarded tarps in one corner, and walked there, lifting the tarps and tucking the main item of the payload under the heavy fabric. Its task complete, the bot walked out of the warehouse, puffing air to scatter dust on the floor and conceal its small footprints. As planned, it walked across the streets of the abandoned base and down an embankment into a muddy creek, where it folded its legs and sank to the bottom. Content that it had performed its task adequately, the bot's last action was to send a power surge into its processor, frying its tiny brain and erasing the last evidence of what it had done. War raged across the main continent of Stiglord, opposing forces engaged mostly in desperate small unit actions, while in the sky, aircraft battled for control of the air, and warships waited in orbit. Both sides knew that unless the invading forces were able to land their second wave soon, the fight for Stiglord could have only one outcome. The Legion and Achakai knew they could only hope to delay the time when they were ground down by attrition and ran out of ammunition. The Wargalan knew they only had to wait until the enemy became combat ineffective unit by unit, while the Ruhar fleet withheld support under the threat of Bosphorak ships that might or might not be in the area. Both sides knew what would inevitably happen over the next 2 or 3 days, and both sides knew there was nothing that could change the outcome. Both sides were wrong. Under a pile of dirty, torn, and discarded tarps, and a long, unused warehouse on an abandoned military base far from any fighting, a timer ended its programmed countdown. Without any sound, a device switched on, providing a small amount of power before the device disintegrated into dust, having done everything it was supposed to do. The device had activated an Elder Power Tap. The power tap pulled energy from another dimension, building up power and sending out chaotic electromagnetic waves that were lost amidst the powerful broad-spectrum electronic jamming from both sides. Then, as the power level intensified, the distinctive electronic signature of an active Elder Power Tap was noticed by both sides. "General Ross for you, ma'am," the sergeant called out to the Maverick's leader, who was still waiting for a dropship to carry her away from the staging area outside Slukhtashwan. "Perkins here," she responded. "Whatever special thing you were going to do," he said in a rush, "don't do it. We've got a hell of a mess on our hands. The Ruhar just detected a freaking Elder Power Tap going active down here. Admiral Kuhn is jumping frigates into orbit and sending dropships down to the site. The enemy is moving in fast as they can. It is already one hell of a huge air battle. The aircraft that were coming to pick you up are being grounded until this shakes out. I've got General Bailey preparing to bring 2 companies to the site, but we're short on transport. If your team had a dropship, I might throw you into the fight."
"Yes, sir," she said slowly, stretching her words out in a monotone. "This is a completely unexpected development. No one could have foreseen this. General Bailey should exercise extreme caution.
He..." "Holy shit," Ross gasped as he caught on. "Unexpected?" She continued to speak slowly, keeping any hint of sarcasm out of her voice in case the Ruhar were listening to the conversation.
"Yes, sir. I certainly had no idea that an Elder Power Tap was on this planet."
"God damn."
"Sir, if I may offer a suggestion, General Bailey and all of our forces should stay out of this particular fight. That includes the Ruhar. If there is a Bosphorak ship over our heads, they will be jumping into orbit and sending down their own dropships to take possession of the artifact. It could develop into a fight between the Wargalan and the Bosphorak until the Jarraptha get here."
"The Jarraptha?"
"The Bosphorak potentially getting control of an active Elder Power Tap is a direct threat to the Jarraptha, sir," she explained. The Giraptha will now be within their rights to intervene here, to ensure their security. They will have to act.
Oh, my fuck. There was a sound like the general thumping his forehead on the console.
Then,
Perkins, I, God damn, an Elder power tap? You had it? Okay, we will discuss this later. I will instruct General Bailey and our Achikai friends to hold off for now.
Sir, any battle over the power tap will be bloody. We should not deprive the Achikai of an opportunity for such glory.
Ah.
He understood right away. If many of the ninjas were slaughtered in the battle, that would be fewer lizards for the Legion to worry about later. He hated having to include political considerations in battle planning, but sometimes it could be very useful. He cleared his throat.
Yes, you are right about that. I will tell the Achikai that we will not stand in their way. Assholes won't listen to me anyway, he added under his breath. Very well. I will advise Admiral Kuhn to watch out for the Bosphorak. The Ruhar would only be a speed bump. Oh, hell, I do not believe this. Colonel Perkins, I suppose I don't need to tell you there is no need for that thing you are going to do.
I don't know what you're talking about, sir.
Good, because you have already nearly given me a heart attack more than once today. Can I expect any more surprises?
It wouldn't be a surprise if I told you, sir.
Shit. I hate this job. Ross out.
The real battle for Stiglord began with a Bosphorak light cruiser and two destroyers jumping into low orbit and immediately launching a dozen dropships evenly split between troop transports and gunships. As the Bosphorak had not expected to get involved in any messy fighting on the ground, most of the personnel aboard the transport dropships were starship crew members with little experience with infantry fighting and a likely tendency to spray everything in sight with rifles on full auto. To avoid anything resembling a fair fight, the Bosphorak broadcast warnings for their client species to stay away from the immensely valuable Elder artifact and threatened dire consequences if the dirtbag Regalin attempted to get their grubby little tentacles on the priceless object. Both sides got a good chuckle out of the obviously ridiculous warning. Then the Regalin disengaged from battle with the invaders and threw everything they had into getting to the Elder device first. Every aircraft and anti-aircraft missile available was launched at the Bosphorak dropships, which were in the vulnerable phase of atmospheric entry and making no attempt to be stealthy. The three Bosphorak warships responded with ripple-firing decoys to cover their dropships and missiles to intercept Regalin aircraft that were flying at maximum speed toward the artifact. Unfortunately for the patron species, by the time they jumped in, the Regalin had two aircraft close to the objective, and the Bosphorak could not risk hitting the Elder device. All six gunships broke away from their primary mission of covering the rapidly descending transports to go into a full power dive while shooting maser cannons at the enemy. One of the Regalin aircraft exploded before the Bosphorak had to cease fire, leaving the squids with one aircraft, a pair of pilots, and four soldiers to complete the mission. Setting down on the cracked surface of what used to be the abandoned base's airfield, the aircraft roared away as soon as the four soldiers exited. Flying low and fast, the aircraft got away from the area as four Bosphorak gunships screamed toward the base, their forward surfaces glowing cherry red from coming down too fast. With sensors partially blinded, the gunship's maser cannons chattered to saturate the area on a low-power anti-personnel setting. The Regalin gave a good fight, but it was never a contest. By the time the two surviving Bosphorak transports touched down, there was no active enemy resistance within 80 kilometers of the objective site, and one of the destroyers above was maneuvering dangerously low in the atmosphere to cover the return flight. Other than the Regalin launching a dozen anti-aircraft missiles in a futile gesture, the return of the two surviving dropships was uneventful, both being taken aboard the light cruiser. More warnings were broadcast for all ships in the area to stay away and not interfere with the three Bosphorak ships climbing out to jump distance. Warnings that were directed more at the unpredictable Achikai than at the sensible Ruhar fleet. Admiral Kuhn had pulled his ships back, and Kakrondo fought to keep his own ships from doing anything uselessly stupid, arguing there would be plenty of opportunities to do usefully stupid things later. Helplessly, the would-be invaders and the defenders watched
as the Bosphorak ships climbed toward jump altitude with their priceless cargo. They almost made it to jump distance before three new ships jumped in to join the battle. A Therenan heavy cruiser and two destroyers emerged from twisted space-time above the Bosphorak. The Therenan ships had been lurking in stealth, keeping a close eye on their asshole supposed allies. When the Legion invasion force arrived so unexpectedly, the Therenan had observed with curiosity and alarm, but took no action for the simple reason that they did not know which side they should support. On the one hand, a mercenary group of their own client species was acting in coordination with the Ruhar, and that could not be good for the Kristang or the Therenan. On the other hand, the Achakai were attacking the Wirgalan, and that could not be good for the Bosphorak. Having no orders regarding whether to interfere, the Therenan commander had been patiently watching and waiting until the signature of an Elder device was detected. The Therenan could have launched their own dropships and engaged in a chaotic battle on the ground, but with the Bosphorak offering convenient and free same-day delivery to low orbit, why bother? The two pairs of destroyers engaged each other in a running battle that carried them arcing over the horizon, while the two cruisers slugged it out at a rapidly decreasing distance, the more powerful guns and shields of the heavier Therenan ship quickly knocking out the normal space propulsion system of their allied ship. Soon the cruisers were pounding each other at point-blank range, blasting away armor plating until the guns and missile launchers of the Bosphorak ship fell silent and the Therenan systematically destroyed the allied ship's point defense systems. The way was then clear for the Therenan to launch dropships stuffed with heavily armored boarding parties and remotely operated combats. The dropships latched on. Soldiers raced out to place blasting charges and blow holes in the disabled ship's hull. Then the armor-suited figures followed the combats inside. 3 light seconds away, where they had been concealed in stealth since shortly after the invasion began, the 5 ships of Captain Scarandum's Ethics and Compliance Office Task Force keenly watched the battle with passive sensors. The task force was unofficial. In fact, they were not supposed to be there at all, but Scarandum was burning with curiosity to see what Emily Perkins had planned. Sadly, 3 of his ships had developed serious engineering flaws, the exact nature of which could be decided later, so they had been forced to delay their next assignment. Whatever Scarandum expected, an Elder freaking power tap was not on the list. "What do you think?" he asked the captain of the It Was Like That When We Got Here.
"Looks good," the other captain responded over the encrypted tight beam. "We are detecting fewer explosions and gunfire from inside the hull. I think our Therenan friends have done the hard work for us. The artifact might be damaged if we wait much longer."
"Agreed. Very well. You go in with the plausible deniability and the out on bail. My ship will provide high cover along with the parole violation. Bring back our prize."
An encouragingly short time later, Sub-Lieutenant Kinsta called from inside the Bosphorak light cruiser.
"Captain Scarandum, we have eliminated all organized opposition, taken control of the ship, and secured the artifact. We have no casualties, and the artifact is undamaged."
"Excellent."
Scarandum could not believe his luck. His task force had been trying to think of an excuse for intervening directly to assure the invasion succeeded, mostly because they had wagered in favor of success, but no one had been able to think up an excuse that wouldn't result in pissing off both the Maxulks and Rindaloo. Now he not only had a solid excuse for direct intervention, he had a priceless Elder power tap. While boarding parties had gone aboard the light cruiser to secure the artifact, the out-on-bail had reduced the Therenan heavy cruiser to scrap, and all 4 enemy destroyers had damaged each other to the point where none of them could move under their own power. It was an amazing success, far better than he could have hoped for. The only issue nagging at the back of his mind was the thought that aboard one of the ECO ships, there was almost certainly some lucky jackass who had drunkenly placed a wager on the extremely unlikely possibility of an Elder artifact being found on Stiglord, and now could not believe the nearly forgotten wager would pay off handsomely.
"Tell Captain Windavon to bring the artifact aboard the It Was Like That as soon as possible, and prepare to jump with us."
"We're not leaving a force here?" Kinsta asked, surprised.
"No, the artifact is too important. We need to report to Admiral Gasoja and let her deal with it."
Gasoja commanded the 4 star carriers that were waiting outside the star system.
The Bosphorak here certainly aren't going to cause any more trouble.
Yes, sir.
One moment while I relay your orders to Captain Windivan. There were a few moments of silence, then acknowledged. Sir, it was very nice of the Bosphorak and Theranin to do all the work for us, so Captain Windivan has a question for you.
Oh, what is that?
Are we supposed to leave a tip?
Chapter 35 The Jarapatha ECO ship will do sketchy things, backed away from the Star Carrier, the crew exulting about another job well done, when the ship's commander announced they weren't done yet. Admiral Gasoja knew that her superiors in fleet headquarters would be enormously pleased when she brought a priceless Elder power tap home with her ships. She also knew they would have questions about how such a supremely rare and precious item just happened to be found on a backwater world. They would want answers. So the Admiral demanded answers from Scarandum, and the ECO task force was going back to question the surviving Bosphorak about what they knew of the incident. It was a waste of time, and Scarandum knew it, and the Admiral knew it. If the Bosphorak knew how the power tap got there, they would have known it was there, and it would not have been there when the invasion force arrived. The Bosphorak were clueless like everyone else. Well, Scarandum thought privately, not everyone was clueless about it. Before he could do anything remotely useful, he had to go through the motions, and that meant jumping back into orbit near the still-smoking wreck of the Bosphorak ship. Signaling the four other ships of the task force to accompany him, he ordered his ship to jump. When the ECO ships returned to Stiglord, Scarandum sent a brief message to Admiral Kuhn, instructing the client species to stay out of the way, and then waited for a boarding team from the parole violation to secure the battered light cruiser again. No trouble was expected from the subdued Bosphorak, and indeed the enemy did not resist, except for a moderate amount of gunfire, plus two grenades, and one call for supporting fire from the plausible deniability, which blew out 20 meters of the Bosphorak ship's hull. When the all-clear was received, Scarandum's dropship flew across the short distance, and he personally supervised the tedious process of interviewing the clueless Bosphorak on the bridge of the powerless ship while his boarding teams checked the ship for booby traps and for aliens who might be trying to hide in the nooks and crannies of the hull. He was on the bridge of the busted light cruiser when the leader of the boarding team called him. Scarandum actually welcomed the interruption as a break from the tedium of listening to various Bosphorak denying any knowledge of how the power tap got to Stiglord.
Captain, I am terribly sorry to bother you like this, Sub-Lieutenant Kinsta said.
Kinsta, Scarandum twitched his antennas in the Jarapatha equivalent of an eye roll.
The lieutenant was nervous about something, and based on Scarandum's experience, he guessed that Kinsta was worried about getting into trouble.
What is the problem?
You, Kinsta sputtered. It's best if you see for yourself.
What his subordinate meant, Scarandum interpreted, was that there was a mess, and the operative wanted to pass responsibility onto someone else.
We're on a tight schedule. Give me a hint, please.
When we left this ship, because we were in a hurry, you understand, we had to, well,
get to the point, Kinsta.
We had to leave the survivors of the Theranin boarding crew in the custody of the Bosphorak.
You what?
Scarandum did not remember the boarding team informing him that they had captured Theranin during the operation to seize the power tap. They had not told him, and he had not asked. At the time, he had more important things to do.
We didn't have time to take the Theranin with us, and this is a Bosphorak ship, so...
Please do not tell me that the prisoners got out and caused problems.
No, they didn't cause any trouble. Sir, it is really best if you...
This had better be good. I'll be right there, Scarandum snapped,
imagining all sorts of complications that he really did not want to deal with right then.
Whatever he imagined, it was not what he found.
What the hell happened here?
He bellowed, his antennas standing on end. It was indeed a mess. He was in the section of the ship the Bosphorak used as a brig, an oval-shaped central hub around which were seven holding cells that had energy fields, electrified bars and doors, and automated laser guns to prevent prisoner escapes. Four of the cells were empty. One contained four Theranin who were gesturing wildly and shouting, though with the energy field engaged, he fortunately couldn't hear them. The cell nearest the entry corridor had its energy field deactivated, and the cell door was open. Kinsta was standing over the body of a Theranin, or it might have been the body of a Theranin, it was hard to tell.
"Damn it," Scarandum groaned. The situation had become complicated. He hated complications. "What the hell is going on?"
Kinsta stared down at the mangled body of what had apparently been a Theranin.
"The Bosphorak guards here told me they think it was a boating accident."
Scarandum gaped at the pair of Bosphorak standing meekly up against the far wall of the hub.
"Boating?"
The pair of Bosphorak heard the translation and bobbed their heads vigorously, doing their best to play the part of innocent bystanders. Turning back to the body on the floor, Scarandum crouched down.
"Looks more like this guy got into an argument with a trash compactor."
"Let's go with that," Kinsta muttered with relief, tapping on his tablet. All he cared about was that he wasn't getting blamed for the mess. Scarandum straightened, looking around.
"What else?"
"This guy,"
Kinsta pointed to the adjacent cell, which contained another Theranin body.
"Apparently got access to a weapon and killed himself."
"He killed himself, huh?"
Scarandum stepped into the cell, avoiding the pools of blood on the floor. The body did exhibit signs of gunshot wounds, and the unlucky Theranin did have a pistol clutched in one hand.
"Kinsta, I count 11 bullet holes."
"So?"
Scarandum bent down to pry the pistol from the dead cyborg's hand.
"So, this pistol holds only 9 rounds."
He looked at the Bosphorak.
"Would one of you care to explain that?"
The Bosphorak looked at the deck or the ceiling, and one of the aliens ventured a guess.
"He reloaded?" "Good enough for me,"
Kinsta tapped again on his tablet.
"Oh, hell," Scarandum sighed. "Is that all?"
"Yes," Kinsta brightened, relieved to have dodged a bullet more skillfully than the dead Theranin had. Scarandum studied the four still-living Theranin in the other cell, who were silently shouting outrage at him, because the energy field absorbed all sound.
"Kinsta, are those surviving prisoners trying to tell me that their fellows did not die by accident and suicide?"
Kinsta peered at the prisoners.
"I can't hear them, sir. They might be trying to order lunch."
"Lunch?"
"Well, I'm hungry," Kinsta said with a blank look on his face.
"I would like to pretend this never happened."
Seeing his subordinate was still tapping on a tablet, he asked, "How are you listing the second dead Theranin?"
I tagged it as assisted suicide."
"That is not remotely believable," Scarandum complained. "We need a better story."
"You're right." He tapped the tablet again. "I'm changing to involuntary assisted suicide."
"Kinsta, please. Just don't tell me any more about this. What do you propose we do now?"
Kinsta looked up at the ceiling, considering his options.
"We could ask the Bosphorak to care for the remaining prisoners until a Theranin ship arrives to repatriate them."
"Care for them?" Scaranda stared at his subordinate. "You trust the Bosphorak to do that?"
"We could ask them very nicely," Kinsta suggested.
"I don't believe this."
"Sir,"
Kinsta lowered his voice,
"do we actually care
about these assholes?"
Scarandum pointed an antenna at the four cyborg prisoners who were silently screaming at him, making rude gestures and almost foaming at the mouth.
"No, I don't care. But somebody above me does, so that makes it my problem."
"If we don't trust the Bosphorak to keep them here, we could put them someplace safe."
Scarandum glanced around the brig, wondering what area of the ship could be more secure.
"Like where?"
"An airlock?"
Back aboard the We'll Do Sketchy Things, Captain Scarandum first dispatched the I'm as shocked as you are to report to Admiral Gasoja that the surviving Bosphorak had not a single clue about how an Elder Power Tap came to be on Stiglord, and that the ECO task force would remain in the area to search the planet for additional artifacts. Hearing that news would please the Admiral,
for Scarandum knew she had placed a significant wager on the success of the invasion. The second thing he did was to signal the Ruhar admiral that it was advisable for that commander to commence landing the second wave of the invasion force as soon as possible, because the Jerraptha could justify remaining in orbit for only a limited time. Admiral Kuhn took the hint, and the assault carriers of the second wave began popping into orbit within half an hour. The third thing Scarandum did was go aboard a dropship and fly down to the surface so he could meet with a human named Emily Perkins to have a little heart-to-heart chat about just how unlikely certain recent events were. Perkins strode into the tent, wiping sweat from her forehead and trying to untangle the knots in her hair. From wearing a skin suit helmet almost continuously since before the landing, her hair was sweat-stained and plastered to her head, a fact that the Jerraptha waiting for her did not care about at all.
"Captain Scarandum, I am pleased to see you again."
"Pleased, yes," the Jerraptha said grumpily. "But not, I think, surprised."
"Excuse me?"
"Colonel, if an Elder Power Tap had not gone active on this world a short time ago, we would not be having this conversation. Your forces on the surface would slowly be overwhelmed by the Wargalan, and my ships would have remained in stealth while we monitored the situation, unable to intervene. Instead, the second wave of your invasion force has landed, and Admiral Kuhn expects to bring the third wave in before the end of the day. With my ships conveniently in orbit to provide cover, the Bosphorak are unable to prevent this world from falling to the Achakai. You will have achieved all of your stated objectives, and perhaps some objectives that you failed to tell anyone about."
"Captain Scarandum, I have no idea what you mean."
"Surely you cannot be unhappy to have obtained a functioning Elder Power Tap." "I am thrilled about that. What I am less than thrilled about is being used for someone else's purpose."
She set her helmet down on a folding table and picked up a water bottle, downing half of it in one thirsty gulp. Wiping her mouth on the sleeve of her skin suit, she cocked her head at the alien.
"Used? That is only true if we do not share the same purpose."
Scarandum clacked his mandibles together.
"That would be easier to determine if I knew what your true purpose is. You," he waggled a claw at her accusingly, "are a devious little human."
"I'm not little." She stood tall, the skin suit's elastic motors helping support her own weary muscles. "My people have a saying, all's well that ends well. My people have a saying, if it seems too good to be true, it is."
"Don't look a gift horse in the mouth," she countered.
"You should look, if it is a Trojan horse."
Seeing her surprise, he added, "Yes, I have studied some of your history. It seemed prudent to gain understanding of your species, unimportant though you are."
"I have plenty more cliches. We could go on all day like this if you like."
"I would not like," he sighed. "Colonel Perkins, while I find it difficult to believe that you had an Elder Power Tap in your possession before you arrived here, I find it more difficult to believe that you just got incredibly lucky."
"My people have a saying. Shit happens. Sometimes it happens to the assholes on the other side of the fight." She made an exaggerated shrug. "I'm not going to argue with that."
Scarandum knew the conversation wasn't going anywhere.
"Fine. Could you give me a hint whether my people are likely to find anything valuable on this world?"
"You will find our eternal esteem and gratitude. That's gotta be worth something, right?"
He hid his eyes behind claws and shook his head slowly.
"Oh, I am getting too old for this shit."
Dave Chaika enjoyed being able to run a hand through his hair, especially since as a civilian, he didn't have to keep his hair trimmed to regulation length. Emily had hinted she wanted him to grow his hair longer, but he hated feeling it brush his collar, and shaggy hair, and a beard made it seem like he was pretending to be a special forces operator. So he let it grow just long enough to annoy NCOs who assumed he was in uniform. The best part of running a hand through his hair was that he could, because he wasn't wearing a skin suit helmet 24/7. The ceasefire with the Wargalan was holding with both sides, honoring both the letter and spirit of the agreement, a fact that was pleasantly surprising to everyone. The squids not only were being cooperative in preparing to surrender their planet, they were generally less bitter and resentful than expected. The lack of hard feelings might have been due to the fact that the new status of the Yacht-Jakai would cause serious headaches for the Kristang, who were the hated rivals of the Wargalan. And from the gleeful knowledge that the Bosphorak, who were even more hated, were getting their asses kicked by the Jarraptha. Knowing that the loss of Stiglord caused pain to their rivals and patrons helped soothe the humiliation felt by the Wargalan. With the Wargalan being quiet and cooperative, the only significant violence on Squid World was between the Yacht-Jakai and the Verdkris, with the human troops caught in the middle and taking no shit from the ninjas. As far as Dave was concerned, the sooner the Legion evac'd from Squid World, the better. And good riddance to the Assassin's Guild. The relative peace and tranquility on the planet meant that off-duty personnel did not need to stay sealed up in skin suits all the time, as long as they had their gear close by for ready use. The first thing Dave had done when he took off his powered armor was to dump a bucket of water over his head, rinsing away the caked-on grime that the suit's internal cleaning mechanisms just never seemed to take care of. "Hey," he waved to the group. Derek and Jesse had dragged crates into a rough semicircle and set up a tarp as an awning, a place to sit around and do nothing during their off-duty hours. "Sir," he nodded to Derek. Hanging out with officers could be awkward. "Chaika," Derek said with a smile, sitting up to toss a chocolate bar to Dave. It wasn't real chocolate, of course, and the version created by the Ruhar always had a caramel aftertaste. Still, it was sweet, and the only chocolate within 1,000 light years. "Thanks." Dave unwrapped the treat and bit into it. "What's up?"
"Nothing much." Jesse was laying back on a stack of crates, drinking from a canteen. He rubbed his forehead, where he had a rash from the helmet liner digging into his skin. Reaching into a pocket, he got a compass that had a mirror under the lid, so he could check the irritated area.
"Forget it, Pon," Dave laughed. "No matter how many times you ask that mirror, you are not the fairest in the land."
Derek offered a high five to Dave.
"Good one."
"Hey." Jesse closed the lid and tucked the compass back in a pocket. "I never said I was Goldie freaking Locks."
I think that mirror thing was Snow White," Dave said.
"You sure about that?" Jesse frowned. "I get that one mixed up with Sleeping Beauty."
"They were both poisoned and fell asleep," Derek said. "Kind of the same thing."
"You know what I wonder?" Dave took another bite of chocolate. "That Snow White chick lived with the Seven Dwarves, right?"
"Yeah, so?"
Jesse wished he hadn't already eaten his own chocolate bar.
"So," Dave asked, "how many of those dwarves you think wanted to bang her?"
"Well, they're guys, so..."
"Seven," Jesse answered, and they all had a good laugh.
"Got to be," Derek agreed. "Unless one of the dwarves was gay," he added.
"If one of them was..." Jesse motioned for chocolate, and Dave broke off a piece and tossed it to him. "I'll bet it was Grumpy."
Derek sat up again.
"Grumpy? Why's that?"
"Think about it. If you were the only gay guy around, you'd be awfully lonely," Jesse explained.
"That would make me grumpy."
"Ah," Derek nodded.
"Makes sense."
"Oh, my God," Shauna exclaimed, as she, Perkins, and Strebik walked under the makeshift awning.
"Is this what you guys talk about when we're not around?"
"Not all the time." Derek swung his legs over the crate. "We had a long conversation about the philosophy of existentialism."
"Really?" Irene laughed. "What do you know about that?"
"I know that most of the people who use that term have no clue what it means."
Derek winked at her.
"Colonel, you don't look happy. What's up?"
Perkins slammed a fist down on a crate.
"This operation was a complete disaster. We didn't do anything we planned."
"Come on, ma'am. Dave's cheeks reddened at his mistake.
"We did some good things that none of it was planned."
She threw up her hands, refusing to be comforted. "We didn't plan for our ships to be shot out of orbit. We didn't plan to crash in the middle of nowhere. We didn't plan to find and capture a plasma cannon site."
"Yeah, but that was a damn good thing," Jesse noted.
because we also didn't plan on Bosphorak ships jumping in to spoil the party.
Fine, sure. Perkins shook her head. That was one good thing. The rest of the op for us was pulling two Verd platoons out of a city where they shouldn't have been in the first place.
What a clusterfuck.
We didn't accomplish anything we had in the plan. The worst part is we gave away our toy. She used the code word for the Elder Power Tap.
It's not a complete disaster, Irene mumbled through a mouthful of a chewy ration bar.
The ninjas own this rock now. We did accomplish our main goal, ma'am. The Ajakai have a homeworld. They can qualify to be recognized as a clan. And that will keep the lizards so busy fighting each other that they won't be going on the offensive against the Ruha for years. Maybe longer.
You're right, Strebik. Somehow we pulled a rabbit out of a hat. Again.
What I want to know. Irene pulled the wrapper down further, but didn't bite into the bar. It tasted like sawdust flavored with cocoa powder, and she decided she wasn't that hungry yet.
Is what's the end game, ma'am? Strebik, that's above my pay grade.
Excuse me, ma'am. Irene tucked the ration bar away in a pocket. But that's bullshit, and we all know it.
It's above your pay grade.
Irene shrugged.
Yes, ma'am. It would be easier for us to help if we knew what the hell we're trying to accomplish out here.
Perkins saw that everyone, including and maybe most especially Dave Chaika, were nodding agreement.
Okay. She took a breath. Not now. You have to trust me on this.
We do, Shauna agreed, though she looked hurt.
All I can say is there are a whole lot of moving pieces, so the next step depends on what the aliens do.
Which aliens? Irene wasn't going to let it go so easily.
The lizards or the Ruha?
Both. Maybe both. It depends, Perkins said. Listen, people. That's all I'm going to say on the subject. That's all I can say. When I know what the hell we're doing next, you'll be the first to know. That's a promise.
Ma'am? Shauna asked. Sergen Jates and Nerd. They're not being read in on this?
No. Perkins shook her head. We can't put them in that position. They might have divided loyalties, and that's not fair to them.
Everyone.
She looked at each member of her team one by one, searching their eyes. That's as far as this discussion goes for now. Drop the subject. We have plenty of immediate issues to deal with.
Irene knew their leader was looking at her.
Yes, ma'am. She agreed.
Dave followed the Mavericks' leader when she walked away.
Em. Hey, Em, wait. You know this wasn't your fault. Why are you so pissed off?
Before answering, she looked around to see if anyone was close enough to overhear.
Dave, we gave up the toy for nothing.
It wasn't nothing.
We won. The Torgula gave us bad intel, the hamsters missed an entire layer of SD satellites and a bunch of Bosphorak warships. This was never going to be easy.
I know that. We agreed that I wouldn't ask you things you shouldn't tell me. So I won't ask what your plans are.
Cashing in the toy for a ride to Earth wasn't ever going to happen. We brought the toy here in case we needed it, and we did. Bad shit happened. We survived. All we can do is learn from it, and hope that we don't need a toy next time. 'Cause we won't have one.
Understanding all that doesn't make me any less pissed off. We had to rely on the Beatles to bail us out twice now.
Yeah, so?
In combat, you utilize all available resources, he reminded her. Besides, the Beatles were looking for an excuse to kick ass here.
I should have thought of something better than giving up the best asset we have.
Dave tapped her gently on the forehead.
The best asset we have is right here. When you think of something better you could have done, then you can get pissed at yourself. And hey, maybe next time we plan for the Beatles to bring in the cavalry. Hopefully before I have to ride a cargo container down from orbit, he added with a wink.
I'll do my best.
She leaned forward and kissed him, not caring who saw the public display of affection.
I have to talk with the Ajakai again. I'll see you at dinner.
Count on it.
Chapter 36 Emily Perkins woke immediately to the sound of a soft thump on the dirt floor of her tent. The floor wasn't actually dirt. There were sort of rubber pads keeping the surface from churning into mud and dust, but the floor wasn't solid. She didn't mind the primitive conditions, because sleeping in a tent assured her the situation was temporary, and that she would someday soon be leaving Squid World behind forever. Any thump in the middle of the night was not a good thing, nor was it good that anything could have made a thump in her tent without her first being alerted by the motion detector, infrared, or other sensors that were supposed to be watching over her, or the guards who patrolled the camp. She was instantly awake, as much from a surge of adrenaline as from long practice in the military. Her mouth opened to draw a deep breath when a dry, rough hand covered her face, and she felt the cold composite barrel of a rifle or pistol pressed to her left temple.
"Colonel Perkins," the harsh voice of a lizard hissed to her. "Do not attempt to call for help."
Silently, in the darkness, she nodded with as little movement as she thought necessary.
"Good. You understand."
The cold muzzle was still against her skin, but the hand lifted from her mouth. A dim light shone, only enough for her to see the shadowy outline of a figure leaning over her, and on the floor, another figure, prone and unmoving. That must have been the thump she heard. What the hell was going on? The figure standing over her was Kristang, but not wearing the uniform of a Verdkris soldier. The lizard also was speaking to her in English, bypassing the need for a translator. She recognized the accent. He was an Achakai. Screwing up her courage, she licked her dry lips and spoke in a whisper. "What's with the dead guy?" There was a soft sound like a sigh or a snort of derision.
"He was sent here by a rival house."
"Sent here to kill me?"
"Yes. My house wishes to have the honor of fulfilling that contract. You would not understand."
The pressure of the pistol pressed against her skin had not relented. She was going to die. There was anger, but mostly there was regret. Regret for tasks not yet completed. Regret for things she had not said.
"Your people had plenty of opportunity before this. Why now?" "Because my leadership wished to wait until our mission here was completed. We now control this world. And yesterday, the Swift Arrows formally recognized my people as a clan of the Kristang."
It may have been her imagination, but it seemed like the assassin stood a bit taller when saying those words. "I know." She raised her voice slightly and the pistol pressed harder against her. Lowering her voice, she added,
"I know that. Because I set up those negotiations between your people and the Swift Arrows. I got the Swift Arrows to appoint Admiral Kakrondo as their representative." "Yes, I and my house, all of my people are grateful to you."
"This is how you show gratitude?"
"Colonel Perkins, my people have been accused of being without honor, yet we have never failed to fulfill a legitimate contract. It is not possible for my house to back out of a contract. Honor must be satisfied."
This, she told herself, is what happens when you ally yourself with a group of assassins. Really, she was not surprised, only sad.
"Then there isn't anything more to say.
Go on." She settled back into the pillow.
"Do it. Get it over with."
To her surprise, the pressure of the pistol at her temple went away, and the figure stood up, drawing to his full height, nearly scraping the roof of the tent.
"My people have fulfilled a dream held for millennia. On behalf of all Achakai, I thank you."
"What?" While she watched, wide-eyed in terror, the assassin raised the pistol to his own temple.
"Honor must be satisfied."
And pulled the trigger. Lizard blood and brain matter splattered the roof and side of the tent, and the body slumped to the floor, the pistol clattering off the side of her cot as an alarm sounded outside and she heard human voices shouting. "Well," she shuddered, coming down off her adrenaline high.
"Ain't that some shit?"
Dave Chaika burst through the tent flap as she swung her legs over to sit on the cot, feeling pleased that she hadn't peed herself even a little. It is odd, she reflected, what your mind focuses on in times of stress.
"Em!"
he shouted, stumbling as he stepped unexpectedly on a bulky object in the darkness.
What happened?
It's fine. She reached up and touched his forearm. It almost made her laugh that he was wearing only boxer shorts and one sock.
Dave, I'm okay, really. Holy shit!
He shone the light of his rifle onto the floor, illuminating the two bodies there.
You killed these guys?
No, they... I guess it was a murder-suicide. She was too tired to explain further. Then more soldiers burst into the tent, and her night became a major pain in the ass. 7 hours later, worn out emotionally, not from fear or excitement, but from the grinding boredom of being asked the same questions over and over, she stumbled back to her tent. No, not her tent. That was taped off as a crime scene, with the UNEF MPs going through the motions of their jobs, even though everyone already knew the full story. She went into a tent that had just been set up, supposedly for the purpose of getting a couple hours of sleep before her next meeting. In reality, there was no way she could fall asleep at that point. All she wanted was to get away from well-meaning people expressing their shock and concern. Yes, it was terrifying, she had responded over and over. No, I'll never get over the shock. Yes, we still have to treat the Achakai as allies or at least as customers. I am still alive. No harm done, see? It was exhausting. There really was only one person in the world, in any of the worlds she had been on, who gave her energy instead of making her tired of interacting with other people. Only one person with whom she could be 100% herself, and realizing that prompted her to make a decision. She pinged Dave Chaika. Hey, he said softly as he closed the tent flap behind himself.
You should be sleeping. Like I can sleep with all that going on.
She pointed toward the roof of the tent, which echoed with the sound of gunships circling as they patrolled the camp, watching for intruders. Human voices, shouting or just talking too loudly, surrounded the tent, soldiers determined not to allow another assassin in their midst. The voices were all human, because the few Verdkris who had been in the camp had been politely but firmly escorted elsewhere, for the simple reason that no one could tell a Verd male from an Achakai. She put a thumb near her chin and pointed it upward.
Lift your faceplate.
Dave hesitated.
Well, I'm on duty, he told her.
Please, I want to see you. He knew what she meant. Helmet faceplates could be set to be completely transparent, yet there was always a bit of a reflection, and with the faceplate closed, the wearer of the suit had to talk through the helmet's external speakers. Dave hesitated. He was carrying a rifle in camp because the area was clearly not safe, and regulations required suits to be sealed for protection against chemical and biological weapons.
I can make it in order if you like. I'm a civilian now, remember?
He broke the seal and lifted the faceplate.
Is this better?
Much. She stood up off the cot and kissed him, awkward because the helmet's chin projected forward.
You know what the scariest part was?
Having a master assassin holding a gun to your head, he guessed, forcing a grin.
No, it was the thought that if I died, there would be so much left that I didn't do.
Is this about windsurfing again? This time, the grin was genuine. They had talked about taking leave to go windsurfing along one of the tropical beaches of Lemuria, where enterprising former soldiers had set up resorts for humans. Neither of them had ever so much as taken a single windsurfing lesson, and the subject had become an inside joke between them.
It's about a lot more than windsurfing.
His grin turned to a frown.
Em, listen. You've got to stop with this shit about feeling the weight of the galaxy is on your shoulders.
He pointed to the tent flap with one hand and cradled her chin with the other.
The Legion has a whole army of people. It's not all on you.
That's not what I meant. She shook her head, searching his eyes for understanding. He was in combat mode, she knew that, and he wasn't able to focus on anything else. All he wanted was to protect her, because he hadn't been able to protect her before. Dropping to one knee, she saw not surprise, but concern in his eyes, thinking something was wrong with her.
I'm fine.
She waved him away when he offered to pull her up. She took a breath.
This is not easy, she thought.
Taking one of his hands in hers, she looked up at him.
David Jacob Chaika, will you marry me?
Damn it! He exclaimed. She cocked her head, not knowing whether to be amused or hurt.
That was not exactly the response I was hoping for.
Sorry, he mumbled, and dropped to his knees, bending forward so he wasn't looking down at her.
It's just, I had a whole speech planned. We were going to dinner at that beach bar we like. Instead, we're in a tent after my girlfriend almost got assassinated by a lizard.
Anyone can get engaged at the beach, she laughed.
We have a great story.
Em, I got a ring and everything.
You did?
Yeah. He kissed her and pulled away.
I was going to wait until we got back to paradise, you know? We don't need any distractions on this rock, especially not you.
You got a ring for me. I don't have anything for you. Pursing his lips, he considered.
I don't think guys wear engagement rings.
She rolled her eyes.
We're 1,000 light years from Earth, on an alien planet. I'm 10 years older than you. You think traditions really matter?
She was 10 years older than him, a fact that neither of them mentioned or cared much about.
Giving the girl a ring is a tradition.
You don't want one?
Of course I want one,
she blushed.
Good, because this one is really special, he explained with enthusiasm. I had it made from a fragment that came from an elder starship, the one that crashed on Paradise.
What? She gasped.
How could you afford that?
The brewery, he said casually.
We're making a lot of money. You didn't know that?
We never talk about business.
Maybe we should.
Before that, can we talk about something else? She tapped his armored chest.
You didn't give me an answer, mister.
Will you marry me? He asked.
Yes.
Oh, hell yes. He grinned before he rolled his eyes and groaned.
What's wrong?
Now I have to plan all the place settings and get a dress and invite bridesmaids and select a cake. Weddings are so much work for the man.
Oh, bullshit, she laughed.
The only thing you will do is show up at the last minute, hopefully not hungover, and in a suit that isn't too wrinkled.
Well, sure, if you insist, he winked.
General Ross had been dreading the call. He was prepared for it, had rehearsed what he would say, had facts and figures ready to back up his argument, and knew that nothing he said would make a difference. Admiral Kuhn also knew the facts, had access to most or all of the same numbers, and nothing he thought would make much of a difference. Kuhn had his orders, and his ability to be flexible was limited. The conversation began well. Ross opened by congratulating the Ruhar leader on successfully landing the invasion force, which they both knew had nearly been a disaster. Kuhn then praised Ross's leadership of the force on the ground, which they both knew had nearly been overwhelmed and defeated. After exchanging pleasantries for an appropriate amount of time, they both expressed their disgust with the unorthodox and surprisingly undisciplined infantry tactics of the Achakai.
It was hell until the Wargalan surrendered, Ross admitted. Now I'm glad that the ninjas don't know shit about organized warfare. We're outnumbered down here. I won't sleep well until we get our last set of boots off the ground. I'm having to deploy all my human troops to keep the Achakai and the Verd separated. That leaves me spread thin. If the ninjas continue abusing the Wargalan, the ceasefire could break down and...
He let out a long breath.
Well, you know what's going on down there.
As we discussed, the priority for space lift will be getting the Verds off the ground first. We will extract them through your territory.
That's going to be tricky, but we'll manage. Any progress on the squids sending transport to pull their own people off this rock?
The ship that brought the surrender agreement to their central government only arrived there yesterday, if it was on schedule. I would not expect a reply for another 3-4 weeks. General Ross, the Wargalan will be very alarmed by this development. I do not think they will easily accept loss of this world.
Yeah, well, they can argue with the facts all they want.
The Swift Arrows have recognized the Yachikai as a clan, and the two major clans allied with the Swift Arrows have offered recognition also.
At a price, Kuhn noted with a frown.
That isn't our problem. It's nice to have something that is not our problem.
Indeed.
Kuhn cleared his throat and got to the part of the conversation they both knew was coming.
General, the operation to extract the Verdcris will commence at 1100 hours tomorrow. My battleship squadron will be departing once the majority of the Legion ground force has been pulled off the surface.
Yeah. Admiral, I wish we could talk about that. The Jirapatha aren't providing cover anymore. If the birds come back, we will be awfully exposed out here. I'm not worried about the squids trying to take back this rock. The Yachikai can handle it without help from the Swift... Kuhn interrupted, his eyebrows lifted with surprise.
You haven't heard?
Heard what? Ross hated being surprised, especially by something his staff was supposed to keep him informed about.
The official communication had not gone out yet. I just thought you might have heard the news from a back channel.
Come on, Ross pleaded. Don't keep me in suspense down here.
Kuhn's face broke into a broad grin, exposing his incisors.
The Bosphorak will not be causing trouble for this world, not for a significant time. Without transport resources and support from their patrons, the Wirgalin are unlikely to mount a serious effort to take back this planet.
Okay. What is going on?
The Bosphorak were very naughty. You know they attacked those two ships the Maxalts were sending to Earth?
Of course, Ross acknowledged, mildly surprised the Ruhar Admiral mentioned it. He had to know that any reference to their lost homeworld was painful for humans to hear. That's why we are out here. It cleared the way for us to take action against a client of the Bosphorak.
That's not all the birds did. We only learned about it this morning when the courier ship arrived. The assumption was the Bosphorak would take their punishment like good, obedient little clients, keep their heads down, at least pretend they are cooperating with the investigation, ride it out until the Maxalks got tired of using bird planets for target practice.
If they're smart, Ross mused, they'll play the long game. Their government plays for time while they try to identify the rogue group who attacked their patrons, get access to the technology. Maybe trade it in exchange for a measure of forgiveness, while keeping a copy of the tech for themselves.
That would be smart. Maybe their government is doing that. But in the meantime, the rogue group isn't just keeping their heads down. They're hitting back.
Holy shit. Hitting back how?
Some kind of ghost ship is out there conducting hit-and-run attacks against Maxalk's ships. The ghost ship crew leaves messages identifying themselves as Bosphorak freedom fighters or some nonsense like that, Kuhn snorted. The ghost ship vows to continue attacks until their oppressors cease their unlawful actions against the peace-loving Bosphorak people. The Maxalks have been chasing the ghost ship all over the sector and beyond with no result. The intel we received lists 7 attacks, and the losses have all been on the Maxalks' side. The reason we care about this is the Maxalks have predictably not backed down to the ghost ship's threats. They are striking the birds harder than ever. For now, and the foreseeable future, the Bosphorak will not be able to send warships here or provide transport to the Wirgalin.
Whew, Ross exhaled. This is a game changer.
It is. General Ross, the situation appears to be a positive development for us in the short term, but it is dangerous. If the rogue faction of Bosphorak are able to deploy their advanced technology with more than one ship, they could become rivals of the two apex species. That would upset the balance of power that has kept the galaxy from blowing up.
The galaxy hasn't exactly been peaceful.
An all-out war between the Maxalks and Rindaloo could devastate the entire galaxy.
I can see that. Admiral, that's above my pay grade. There's nothing humans can do to affect the outcome one way or another.
I do not see there is anything my people could do either, Kuhn lamented. The result of this new information
is I am being ordered to accelerate the extraction from this world. Our fleet is pulling back to a defensive posture to prepare for trouble. Your people will be on the sidelines until this shakes out. Ross grunted. Privately, he thought the Ruhar pulling back to a defensive posture would mean more work for the Alien Legion, not less. There would still be a need for fighting, and the Ruhar would especially not want to get their own federal army tied down and stamping out fires. They would rely on the Legion, because those troops were considered expendable.
I'm sure you're right about that, he lied. You're telling me this because you think we don't need to worry about any Bosphorak warships crashing the party here?
Yes.
I'd like to see the intel.
It was just transmitted to your command.
Thank you. I'll need to look at it, but it sure sounds like the birds have to worry about their own problems. I will get my staff to dust off the contingency plans to accelerate the evac. Like we agreed, we pull the birds off this rock first. Admiral, I would like you to keep a couple of destroyer squadrons in orbit until the last Legion boot steps off the ground. The Achakai have their own ships overhead, and their leaders must be considering that it would be useful to have Legion soldiers as hostages.
Kuhn's laugh was bitter, but sounded comical because of his slightly squeaky voice. If the Achakai are not looking for an opportunity to take hostages, I would be very disappointed with them. General, I have already planned to keep one destroyer squadron plus three cruisers here until the evacuation is complete. That does not include any sort of liaison team you plan to retain here.
We are not planning to leave a single human or bird on this rock.
I wasn't talking about your plans, Kuhn explained. I do not know what Colonel Perkins intends to do next.
Shit. Neither do I. Thank you. I'll get the revised schedule to you ASAP.
Getting his command staff up to speed, then quickly reviewing the existing contingency plan and ordering changes, took nearly an hour. Perkins was not able to speak privately for another 20 minutes, during which time Ross wondered what to say. By the time she called on a secure channel, he still had nothing.
I suppose you've heard the big news, he opened.
Yes, sir, holy shit.
That was my reaction.
Have the bird brains lost their fucking minds? She asked.
Either that, or they think they can win the fight in the long run.
Wow, she whistled. That is one hell of a gamble.
Maybe not. The Bosphorak have had the boots of the Maxulks on their necks for a long time. They've got to be sick of taking shit from their patrons. Somebody in their society decided that hitting their overlords directly is worth the risk. You understand this is an extremely dangerous development. The Maxulks can't back down or they would look weak, and whatever group is flying that ghost ship sounds like true believer fanatics. They won't back down.
I wonder about that.
What?
Did you read any of the messages from the ghost ship?
Some of it. Typically bomb-throwing revolutionary bullshit, why?
It sounds familiar. A little too typical, you know what I mean? It's like whoever wrote those messages wants us to think they are irrational fanatics.
I see what you mean, he said, as he made a note to ask his intel people to look at the ghost ship's messages.
Sir, does this all seem a bit too convenient?
I'm not following you, Perkins. It is convenient for our evac plan, but...
No, I meant my bullshit detector went off when I read the original report about the birds destroying the two ships headed for Earth. We are supposed to believe the Bosphorak miraculously developed technology that neither the Maxulks nor Rindaloo have? The bird brains suddenly made a game-changing discovery, created a weapon neither of the apex species thought of over thousands of years. Do you think that happened? Or is it more likely the tech came from the spiders?
Colonel?
Ross's head was spinning. Sir, think about it. It is a hell of a lot more likely this magical tech belongs to the Rindaloo, but of course they can't use it directly without triggering all-out war with the Maxulks. So, maybe they gave a piece of their tech to the bird brains to use against their patrons. The Rindaloo sit back and watch their enemy's coalition fall apart while they get to deny any involvement. The Bosphorak don't actually understand how the tech works, so there is no risk it can spread and threaten the Rindaloo.
Shit, Perkins. The inside of your head must be a scary place.
I can't be the only person who thinks the scenario in the official report smells like BS. Either we believe that Bosphorok scientists pulled off the greatest Hail Mary play in the history of the galaxy, or we try to imagine who benefits from us thinking the Bosphorok developed the tech on their own.
Oh, damn it, Perkins. I had a headache when I got out of the sack this morning. I don't need you making it worse. It doesn't matter what we think. What matters is the Maxalts think their clients did it.
Officially, they think that way, yes. They're not stupid.
Ross knew that Perkins's inventive mind would spin with a dozen scenarios, none of which helped with his immediate task of pulling the Legion off the planet. Let's put that aside. Our hamster overlords are accelerating the schedule for pulling us off this rock. They will cover the evac, but they aren't providing a permanent presence here. What I'm saying is, if you have any plans to remain here as a liaison, or to advance whatever devious plan you have cooked up, you need to—
No, sir. I'm as eager to get off this rock as everyone else. The Swift Arrows recognize the Yachikai as a clan. Our mission is done here. All we could do is get caught in the middle while lizards kill each other.
Ross leaned back in the chair, relieved. His fear was that Perkins had been given secret orders by UNEF HQ, or had plans to go off on her own. That's good to hear. The Ruhar planned to pull back their forces into a defensive posture, all across their territory.
Makes sense. That means more work for us.
Agreed. Admiral Kuhn thinks the opposite, he chuckled.
The fighting isn't going to stop, and somebody has to be the trigger pullers. Sir, actually, I was going to contact you even before we got word about this ghost ship nonsense. I need to request permission to leave the theater.
Leave? To go where?
That depends. The sure thing is waiting for me, so I don't need to arrange transport.
Is this more secret squirrel crap you can't tell me about?
He hated that aspect of his job. He hated it even worse when Perkins did something that not even UNEF HQ knew about in advance, because HQ then asked Ross what the hell was going on. Technically, he was her commanding officer, only for the current mission, but his leadership didn't see it that way. Sir, all I can say is we stirred up a lot of trouble here. Poked a hornet's nest with a stick. The Kristang are in disarray, and that is nothing but good for us and our allies. I'd like to keep that momentum going.
Very well. He didn't feel like putting energy into a useless argument. You're looking for targets of opportunity?
Yes. UNEF HQ gave me broad authority for the next phase of the operation.
He snorted. They didn't tell me about the next step.
Don't you have enough shit to worry about already?
It's the shit I don't know about that gives me a headache. All right, Perkins, permission granted. Do me a favor.
Sir?
If you visit Lizardville, bring back a vintage bottle of that Shays crap they drink.
We can't drink it, she cautioned. It's incompatible with human.
Well, it's not for me. I want it for the next time we accept the surrender of a group of lizard assholes.
Oh, she laughed. Got it. Will do.
Chapter 37.
The lizards came aboard the Sure Thing, rather than her taking a dropship to one of their ships. Mostly that was because she was safer aboard a Jurap the ship, even if it was an old star carrier that had been converted into a shady merchant-slash-smuggler vessel. But also because making the lizards come to her made a statement about who had the power in the relationship, and also because, well, fuck them. When the chief lizards of the Fire Dragon Clan walked down the ramp of their gleamingly clean dropship and stepped on the deck of the Sure Thing, they started to launch into an achingly dull ceremonial greeting, which was cut short by her security detail pointing rifles at the ugly lizards, demanding they stand still to be scanned to verify they weren't carrying weapons.
Colonel Perkins, said a lizard who had a bearing a bit more diplomatic than his pissed-off companions. We have complied with your terms and are not carrying weapons. Surely it is not best to begin negotiations with a gesture of mistrust that—
Perkins held up a hand. You can stop right there. I don't care whether you trust me, and I sure as hell don't trust you. As far as I know,
One of you, she glared from one lizard face to the next, hired the Yacha Kai to kill me. You requested this meeting, I didn't. If you're going to waste my time, I have better things to do.
Ah, the lizard nodded sagely. Your reputation for diplomacy is justified.
Captain Gumbano looked up from the scanner he had used.
They're clean, Colonel.
Perkins acknowledged that with a curt nod. Fine, then. I'll try being diplomatic. What do you want? The talking lizard looked to the most gaudily dressed of the group, who made a hand gesture, apparently telling his spokesman to get on with it.
We do not wish to insult your intelligence, the lizard spokesman said, with an expression like he could not stomach speaking to a human. To a female. The recent alliance between the Swift Arrow Clan and the Dishonored Ones is...
Between the Swift Arrow Clan and the Shining Dagger Clan, she corrected him, using the name the Yacha Kai had chosen for themselves. They are a clan, now, recognized by more than enough clans to represent a majority in your governing council.
Yes. The lizard looked stricken. Quite so. This alliance,
he could not bring himself to say the name of the newest Kristang clan,
is disruptive and dangerous with the former Ajakai.
He decided on a compromise.
Allied with them, the Swift Arrows now present a threat to all major non-allied clans.
What she wanted to say was boo freaking who, but instead she settled for keeping the lizards pissed off and off balance. Yep. Sure sounds like you have a major problem. Why should I care?
Because, the spokesman closed his eyes painfully, avoiding the murderous glare of his leaders. My clan is threatened. We wish to restore the balance of power.
Bullshit, Perkins thought to herself. They wanted to tip the balance of power in their favor. Interesting. Why are you here, rather than trying to negotiate alliances with other clans?
Because the clans with significant military power have all declared for one of the existing alliances. There are a few subclans who might be persuaded to change sides for a price, but we do not feel they could be trusted. Colonel Perkins, the rules which have governed our society quite effectively for millennia have been discarded by the rise of the former Ajakai. We hope you appreciate the great damage this has caused to our society.
You are here to lecture me?
No, the spokesman closed his eyes again. We only wish for you to understand the seriousness of the situation.
I am terribly sorry about that. You haven't answered my question. Why are you here?
Because, the lizard swallowed hard, choking on his own words, to restore the balance of power, we wish to conclude an agreement with you.
He looked away, unable to look her in the eyes.
We wish to hire the Alien Legion.
There it is. Perkins kept her very satisfied smile from showing. Hire the Legion? To fight for you against other clans?
Yes.
Huh. She pretended to be thinking about the shocking proposal, pretending to be shocked at all. I have to say your timing isn't the best. The spokeslizard looked at his leaders, then ventured a question.
We do not understand.
She snorted, allowing the grin to break onto her face. You need to get in line, pal. The Black Trees and two other clans already contacted the Legion, she lied. All I can say is you had better make a very tempting offer, or you are out of luck. The lizards murmured amongst themselves angrily, until the most gaudily dressed one turned to glare at her, less with hatred than with resignation.
Colonel Perkins, please.
He looked at his fellow clan leaders who gestured for him to continue.
Name your price.
This is the end of Freefall, a Podium Audio production. If you enjoyed this audiobook, we would love for you to rate and review it. For more sci-fi space adventures, check us out at podiumaudio.com and sign up for our newsletter. We promise we won't spam you. Also, consider joining our community of listeners, fans, and trolls on social media. We're active on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit. We'd love to connect. You have been listening to Freefall, Book 2 of Expeditionary Force Mavericks, produced by Emily Durr, written by Craig Allenson, performed by R.C. Bray. Text copyright 2020 by Craig Allenson. Production copyright 2020 by Podium Audio. All rights reserved.
Bezenson thought that the That's it. Their supplies were aboard two dropships and would be transferred to the assault carriers. But the Thurthing's job was not done. It had to lisp.
Gosh, Kurt whispered.
Kurt?
The fuck is Kurt?
The ship moved, and the bulkhead he almost had within reach of his fingertips. All three reactors vented their plasma and schlut.
What?
While he flew, he kept the laser range gunfinder blarkin. Several soldiers turned and dropped to one knee, rifle pointed at your balls. On the ground, the dinky little weapons looked like they would have trouble shooting down a pension.
What the fuck is a pension?
Coordinates for Wargalan soldiers, even a platoon-sized formation of soldiers, was necessarily... Below, the formation of whistles...
Whistles are coming to get us! Ooh!
Initially, the first units were tasked with hitting enemy artillery... Admiral Sachel's 67th Fleet had also participated in the Battle of Luck. It didn't happen like... Relax, Captain. I downloaded the flight recorder video remotely while you were away on the way, and there, and stuff. They changed course to fly near a Theranin heavy cruiser that was struggling to recover from damage to its normal space propulsion system.
As your opponent is clearly not any kind of a gentleman, he should not be trusted to take a protest with proper seriousness.
Well, this is really not good, he shouted at Captain Grace, who wisely was in the proper luck position for a crack.
What?
The pain was worse after the bandage was applied, and he definitely could feel something moving under around his balls. The current commander of Boneyard Site 2 was an officer with a rank roughly equivalent to Major, named Osguth Fornalfon.
Hold, Dave said in a whithless breath.
Whithless breath?
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.